I'm not coming back for 30%. I'm coming back for everything.
You got into Harvard Law?
What, like it's hard?
Scarface on repeat. Scarface on repeat. Constant, y'all.
Catch a painted pony on the spinning wheel ride.
Some people are saying that your new music sounds a lot like Bob Dylan.
Well, maybe Bob Dylan sounds a lot like me.
She doesn't even go here. They knew, and they let it happen.
Oh, and in case I don't see you.
Good afternoon, good evening, and good night.
Indeed, 94.9 Radio Western. You are tuned in to Outside the Frame, London's only movie talk show. My name is Elijah.
I'm Ryan.
I'm Sam.
It works. Whoa. Thank goodness. Wow. And we're Outside the Frame. We're London's only movie talk show. We talk about films, the culture that surrounds them, so on and so forth. And we have an exciting episode today. Unfortunately, we are not joined today by the one and only Mike.
Mike the Bicycle. Michael the Bicycle.
Michael Bicycle. Not here today. Just got a lot going on right now, which is unfortunate because today is a very fun and exciting episode. So this would have been the one to be at, but that's okay. You know what? We wish Mike the best. That seat's looking hella empty without him. Sam, you're calling in from, where are you right now?
I'm in Italy right now.
You're in Italy
right now. Yeah. I'm in Maiori, just on the Amalfi Coast. Today we spent the day in Positano, but I couldn't miss this for the world.
Now, it looks like you have just gotten back from the bar. Is that correct?
No. We actually didn't end up going out tonight, but this is just my Positano outfit. So.
Okay. Well, there you go.
Right on. You look like you're dressed for Italy.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Now, this is very this is confusing on so many levels for people listening. Because people who are listening via radio, via our stream, cannot see you. And we are currently streaming on Twitch right now as well. They can't see you either. So this is a lot of fun, us just describing what you're wearing. This is good radio.
Yes.
This is what we're at.
Everyone knows the best thing you could do on radio is try to describe visual things.
Yes, I agree.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that we can all truly agree on that.
Yes.
Now we have. I am. Where's
Google? You okay. Are clicking a lot of.
I'm
tabs.
Clicking a lot of different tabs, but it's because. Okay, there we go. It's because I need a lot open. Because today is a very important episode, as I've said multiple times now. But that is because today is part two of our top 25 movies of the past 25 years list. For those of you who do not remember, we all painstakingly put together a top 25 movies that span the past 25 years so far of the 21st century so far, is another way to put it. We did 25 to 21
right
last month.
Yes.
So we're doing five per month. It'll be the first Tuesday of every month where we go through five of our selections. To count down what we have decided is the list. Pardon me. Last time we spoke about some fun films, we had The Grand Budapest Hotel,
yep.
Mean Girls,
yep.
Zero Dark Thirty,
yes,
and not in this order, by the way.
Yeah.
We had Little Women,
yep,
and then we also had the film that I'm forgetting right now.
Why are we forgetting this film? We picked it.
We did pick it.
I'm also forgetting it at the moment.
Do you remember what the last film is?
The last film was Zero Dark Thirty that we talked about.
Okay, it was The Grand Budapest Hotel, Mean Girls, Avatar, Little
right.
Women, and Zero Dark Thirty.
Right, Avatar.
That is correct.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You remember that, Sam?
Yes, I do. Yes, I was, yes.
Okay, perfect. Good. Just making sure you're still with us.
Right.
All right, so without further ado, I don't see any other reason to prolong this. So why don't we just jump into it right now? If that's okay with you guys.
Yes, let's get into our number 20 pick.
All right, our number 20 pick is none other than The Dark Knight.
Then why do you want to kill me?
I don't want to kill you. What would I do without you? Go back to ripping off mob dealers? No, no, no. No, you. You complete me.
You're garbage. You kills for money.
Don't talk like one of them. You're not. Even if you'd like to be. To them, you're just a freak. Like me.
The Dark Knight is our number 20 pick. This was
Where's Rachel?
This was directed and written by none other than Christopher Nolan. It was co-written also by Jonathan Nolan and David S. Goyer.
Yeah.
This movie stars Christian Bale, Heath Ledger, Michael Caine, Maggie Gyllenhaal, Aaron Eckhart, Gary Oldman, Morgan Freeman, amongst
it's a stacked cast.
It's a very stacked cast.
Would you know what? And I'm sorry, I don't mean to derail the episode already because I know we're just in the middle of this. There's very clearly a clip in my head of Stephen A. Smith on a show back in the day talking about The Dark Knight. Have you seen this?
I have not.
He basically goes, and he's trashing Maggie Gyllenhaal throughout it.
Yikes!
Saying that he wishes. They had, you know, somebody like Halle Berry in the role of the love interest instead.
Right, right. Wow, Stephen A. Smith, just known for his, just notoriously known for his good takes. You know what? This movie, getting us back on track. This movie is
about
someone known who's, you know, not too well known, whose name is the Joker, wreaks havoc and chaos on the people of Gotham.
Gotham City.
And Batman, James Gordon, and Harvey Dent must work together to put an end to his madness.
Gordon!
I really wish Mike was here, man. This is
Dude,
this
he
is,
would,
this
I
is
think
tough.
If Mike was here, this he is would tough. He would leave.
He might have actually left by now. So this movie won
I think
two.
Your impression is wonderful.
Thank you. I think it's pretty spot on.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You should have been second in line.
I know. It's okay. I was 7 at the time this movie came out, so I don't think I was getting the role.
Next time.
This movie won 2 Oscars. One for supporting actor for Heath Ledger, one for sound editing. It made $1.009 billion.
That's a lot of money
at the worldwide box office, and $535 million domestically. This is our Christopher Nolan / our superhero movie entry. This kind of helped us put two into one.
Yep.
We knew we had to get a Christopher Nolan film in here. We knew we also and you know there is a lot to be said about superhero movies. Obviously, one of the biggest quote unquote genres of the past 25 years.
Absolutely.
Blockbuster wise, culturally, it's just up there.
And I mean really right off the bat too. I think the year 2000 has the first X-Men in it, right? Or 2002 is the first X-Men?
I believe 2000 was the first X-Men.
Okay.
I believe 2002
was
X2.
And 2002 also would have been the first Spider-Man by Sam Raimi.
That 2001, I believe, was the
really?
First, was the first
okay.
Spider-Man.
Well, there you go. You learn something new every day.
Yeah,
but
regardless, I mean, pretty close to right out the gate. 2008 was the year that this movie came out. What a way to come out. Now, this is obviously the follow-up. Mm-hmm. This is the second movie in the Christopher Nolan Batman trilogy. This is the first movie of any Batman movie to not have the word Batman in it. This follows Batman Begins.
Really?
Yeah.
Batman is never said during it.
No. In the title.
Oh, in the title. Okay.
Yes. Okay, yes. In the title, sense. Anyway.
Yeah.
So this movie, for all the superhero movies, obviously Marvel kind of wreaked havoc on the superhero genre, and you could argue film in general over the past 25 years, or really over the past, 15, give or take, 15 to 17. But this movie... I think stands very tall amongst all of its competition.
Yes, absolutely.
Which
it's the best.
It is the best.
I think it is the best superhero movie. Obviously, you can make your arguments in terms of events that have happened. Right, Endgame was a huge event.
That's right.
You could talk about some other films up there as well in terms of the superhero genre. Maybe Spider-Man 2 in 2004.
Yeah,
that's always put up there as well as being one of those really. Important films in that genre, but essentially what we're talking about is a type of genre film that has very much dominated this kind of century, and The Dark Knight takes it in a very different direction in a sense that it is somehow both extremely comic booky and extremely uncomic booky at the same time.
That's right. That's oh sorry Sam, it looked like you were about to say something.
Yeah. Yeah, I've actually, everyone that I've told about this episode today, I've mentioned The Dark Knight is on this list, and every single person has said that is the greatest superhero movie I've ever seen. And I think circling back to what Ryan was saying, absolutely, the quality of it and just every single shot and just the way that it's done, I think absolutely just knocks the other ones out of the water.
Yeah, it certainly does. And, you know, I usually like to say that, you know, comparison is the thief of joy, because we are going to have to compare it to the other movies. But that also comes up because a lot of the reason that this movie stands so strongly against its competitors is because the tone.
Yes.
That the movie has, the stakes that the movie presents, and the gravitas that this movie has. Now, the stakes in this movie, there's a lot of, one of the biggest criticisms of MCU movies is that, you know, they have to save the world. They have to save the entire world. So when you've saved the entire world, how do you follow that up? How do you make any stakes after that followed up really feel that, how can you be invested, right? How can it feel that big if the biggest thing is the threat of the world and you've now solved that?
Yep.
This movie does a very good job at keeping it central to Gotham and someone who's just wreaking havoc, not only on Gotham, but trying to turn its key figure
in
Gotham.
Right.
Which is a very interesting concept. And, you know, the back and forth of this movie has been compared to other movies, primarily the movie Heat.
Yes.
But I think if you just try to take that away in the grand scheme of things, if you try to take it away from other movies like Heat, I've heard it compared to Unbreakable as well. I think this movie, for that reason alone, for the tone and the gravity, I think that it really stands firm amongst everything else.
I mean, it's the ending, or at least the last third act. I mean, we talk about stakes. It's more the stakes are... There definitely is like real stakes in it in terms of people on the line, but it ends up becoming philosophical stakes, and it's two competing philosophies, and that's basically what the movie ends up being about. And so I think it, you know, non-comic book fans and who are maybe not into that stuff, they still like The Dark Knight from a sense that it does stand out. It goes against the grain a little bit.
I like that. I think that's what we really want from movies of a certain very popular genre. Like, it's bringing in people who aren't necessarily a fan of that genre. And I think that that's really most of what you can ask for.
Agreed.
Do you guys have a go-to moment in The Dark Knight?
I mean, it's part of why I chose the interrogation scene as the clip.
Yes.
Because it's just so... It's the moment that we've been waiting for the whole movie, when the Joker and Batman can finally meet each other and have that face-to-face that we've been waiting for. I brought up Heat earlier, but it's similar to Heat when Al Pacino and Robert De Niro finally get that sit-down moment.
Right.
It's what you've been waiting for this whole movie, and then you finally get it. So that would probably be my go-to.
Yeah, because I don't believe they have a face-to-face in that movie until the interrogation scene.
They don't.
They meet on the street... Before that, when he gets captured.
But, like, Batman is, like, quote-unquote, like, incapacitated.
So, yeah. I mean, obviously, when you speak of The Dark Knight, you can't, you know... The conversation quickly becomes about Heath Ledger, because is this movie the same movie without Heath Ledger? It's hard to say. It's hard to say, because he kind of... His, you know, the legend of him kind of towers over this movie in such a way.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I mean, he won the Oscar for it. The first actor to ever win an award for a comic book.
Oh, true.
To portraying a comic book character.
He probably wasn't the first to win it posthumously.
No, there had been other actors to win it posthumously, but
only in a handful of actors.
And he does something so electric with this movie, with his performance in this movie. Sorry. He's so captivating as the Joker, which, I mean, it's an all-timer performance.
Yeah.
Especially for this millennium so far. This century so far. Sorry. Technically the millennium so far as well. But he is really... He rides a very interesting line and tightrope walk between menacing and charismatic. you are rooting for him.
Right.
But he is also completely insane. He is an absolute sociopath, but he is so smart at what he does. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the choices that Heath Ledger brings to that maniacal laugh, with the small details like the licking of his lips.
Yeah.
It just adds details that otherwise you wouldn't have thought about this movie. So to answer your question, Ryan, I don't know if this movie is the same without him.
Probably not.
Because his performance elevates this to a whole new level.
It's also just, like you said, it's just a masterclass, especially for actors, in developing a backstory for your character and how to convey that. Because really, we don't figure out much. He gives different interpretations of where he's from and everything. That's the whole point of that character. But Heath's performance gives so much that you have a hint, you have an inkling as to what went on in his past.
Yeah. Sam?
I agree. I think it's a phenomenal character. I wish if this were a top 25 best performances of the 21st century, I have no doubt in my mind that this would probably be one of the top 5 performances. Absolutely unbelievable. And I agree. I think it makes the movie so much more monumental as well.
Yeah, yeah, it's an incredible performance, and I don't know if you guys any final thoughts before we move on to our next feature, our next film.
I was gonna mention one small thing. I think that I feel like we've had so much chat about Chris Nolan movies, and I think it's obviously a no brainer that we had to put a Chris Nolan on the list, and I'm really glad that it is this one because this might just be a personal thing, but sometimes I walk away from his movie, I'm like, that was a really good movie, and then I never think about it again. But this is one of the few movies where I've walked away from it, and I've like been like, yeah, actually, that was, how did he do that? And this was unbelievable. And so I'm really glad that we chose this one. I think it has a really great place.
It's a very good point, actually. This is, I would argue, most likely, at least in my personal opinion, by far his most rewatchable movie. Oppenheimer, while some people might argue that's his magnum opus, that's also a 3-hour-long biopic. So while it is a good movie, it was your favorite of the year that it came out.
Yep.
I wouldn't say it's insanely rewatchable, at least not as much so as The Dark Knight. And I think that for that reason, it's a great pick as well. That's a great point.
You got a favorite line
from The Dark Knight?
Yeah.
Probably. I just can't think of it right now.
I'm not wearing hockey pants.
Oh, okay. Yeah, or Where Is She? That's a great one,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that's another great one.
Yeah. Let's move on to our number 19 pick. Speaking of Christian Bale.
I can't believe that Bryce prefers Van Patten's card to mine.
But wait. You ain't seen nothing yet. Raised lettering. Pale nimbus. White.
Impressive. Very nice. Let's see Paul Allen's card.
Look at that subtle off-white coloring. The tasteful thickness of it. Oh my God. It even has a watermark.
For our number 19 pick is American Psycho. So this movie was directed by Mary Harron. It was also co-adapted by her. This is an adaptation of the Brett Easton Ellis novel. It was adapted by Mary Harron and Guinevere Turner.
Yep.
It stars Christian Bale, Chloe Sevigny, Willem Dafoe, Justin Theroux, Reese Witherspoon, and it is about a wealthy New York investment banking executive, Patrick Bateman, who hides his alternate psychopathic ego from his coworkers and friends as he delves deeper into his violent, hedonistic fantasies. That's just a little brief description that really can't sum up what happens in this movie. A lot does happen in this movie, and it's a very interesting one.
Yes,
to see. Now, why is it on our top 25 list of the year so far? Because I mean, out of all the movies that we're about to talk about, at least today, I believe it made the least amount of money. It made $34 million worldwide.
Oh my. That's...
And 15 domestically.
Ooh.
So it wasn't nominated, win any Oscars whatsoever like that. Came out in the year 2000.
Yep.
So one of our earlier picks in this entire list. But there is something about this movie that has stuck with the zeitgeist and stuck with film culture for 25 years. And I want to ask both of you what you think that might be, because people are still talking about it. It's still being memed. There are so many reasons why this movie, it's still in a lot of Letterboxd top fours. It is forever ingrained in film bro culture. So why do you both believe that this movie is so, I'll get into my reasonings afterwards, but why you feel that this movie is so ingrained in our culture?
I think there's, obviously there is a sense that sometimes it's misinterpreted by a group of people, but I don't think that's the main reason why it's lasted so long. I don't think a misinterpretation can't go that far.
Yeah, it doesn't have the legs to carry it as far as it has.
I think people just, you know, it's for a movie that is so incredibly violent, it is absolutely hilarious.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because in my notes I had that it was bar for, with the exception of Mean Girl, bar for bar, this might be the funniest movie on our list.
Yeah, because it's just, it just looks at everything, especially in terms of what was going on at that time, but still, it's still relevant today in terms of the shallowness of certain industries and how people treat one another. And it's the idea of people having to put on a role as well. It's the things that Bateman gets up to and the things that he says are just so absurdly funny. And I think it's because it's paired up with that violence in a way, that this is a guy who's doing horrific things throughout the movie. Now, obviously, there's a sense that, does he do it? Does he not? It's left ambiguous, but he is. We do see him do horrific things. And then he's just losing his mind over these just like small little everyday life things of, you know, business cards. And
that was the scene I was trying to play.
Yes. At going to restaurants and stuff and just him losing his mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I was really hoping that you guys would take the reins on this one, because for this movie, I've never like felt all that deeply about it. But I think that what I think at least is that it sort of is like Taxi Driver in a way, where it like the main character is obviously not that great, but people I think find almost a sort of sense of enjoyment in watching an extreme outsider live and try to figure out regular life. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, yeah.
Right.
And it often does get compared to movies like Taxi Driver.
It is kind of like comedic Taxi Driver.
Yeah, that sort of outsider perspective that, I don't know, people like to see, you know, the discomfort of that sort of thing.
For sure. 100%. So I love the face that you're looking at us with. Like, come on, you know what I mean? I think this movie.
I hope I'm putting this into words right, but
no, you are, and I completely understand what you mean. I think this movie is a fantastic. I think it's a fantastic and very funny takedown of 80s Wall Street fintech bro culture, and perfectly encapsulates how predatory and narcissistic, and materialistic all that entire culture is. And I think it does really well at describing that. I think it does what some of the best satires do, or at least in my opinion, what the best kind of satires do is taking something that, you know, is obviously the writer or the director has an issue that they particularly have with movies or society as a whole, and just crank it to 11. And they really set, and they really exit, like, what's the word I'm looking for? They really exaggerate it. They really make it hyperbolic so that they can show you, okay, this is how crazy it would be if this actually, you know, if it was this level, but it's actually still being done. It's just a little bit more hidden. It's not as outlandish, but I love when they go outlandish with it, because it really throws it in your face to a point where you can't ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that by making this Wall Street guy probably the most predatory person you can be, a serial killer, And they do this in so many great ways. I mean, obviously the killing sequences, obviously the often memed business card scene.
Yep.
Let's see Paul Allen's card. And I really wish I could have played it because it is so funny. Christian Bale plays that part so well, and how the stakes for him over a business card are so high.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, he's just this whole you can feel just by his delivery alone, you can feel the pit of his stomach dropped. And he's like, oh, my God, it's printed on bone white. You know, like this is stuff that nobody should care about because they're so materialistic and so narcissistic. That is what really eats at them the most. I think that this is also one of the few movies that falls into the category where, you know, the movie is better than the book it is adapted from. I don't know if that is likely just me. I would have liked to have heard Mike's take because I believe he's also read the book and.
Not a lot of people have read the book.
No, not a lot of people have read the book.
I can't say I have.
But I do find that the movie is a lot better.
Yeah.
And for anybody who may have misinterpreted this movie as, a glorification of a Wall Street type bro, this movie was written by a gay man. And was who has never worked Wall Street.
Yep.
And this movie was adapted, directed, and written by two women.
Yep. Yep.
So I mean, that kind of tells you most of what you need to know about what direction this movie was trying to head in. Christian Bale himself has even said that this is a complete takedown of that type of character and hates that it gets glorified that way. Now this is also the first time. This is also the first chance that we get to see Christian Bale as a leading star.
Yeah.
It's a bold role to go with.
It's a bold first step.
And I believe there was a couple actors who turned down the role too.
Including Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah, Leonardo DiCaprio turned it down. It's like, I'm not doing this.
Yeah. See, when you're Leonardo DiCaprio and you just had Titanic,
yep.
And you know, you've had
Romeo and Juliet.
Romeo and Juliet. Thank you. He's had other leading roles. This is like Timothy Chalamet after Call Me by Your Name, right? He's in a spot in his career, or Leonardo DiCaprio was in a spot in his career where every step mattered at that point. You know, because he was already on the rise. Christian Bale, this was his chance, and if he misstepped, you know, maybe he can like go back and kind of find his footing. But he really didn't have to because it really paid off for him.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting that we get Batman. This is how we get Batman.
It is interesting that, he later gets cast as Batman. Potentially, maybe, you know, because he can do the whole, you know, walking in a suit and do the whole Bruce Wayne kind of thing, potentially. Kind of crazy early period for Christian Bale in the 2000s here.
Yeah. We get one of the I think undisputably one of the best leading actors of his generation, of this decade so far. And it really, like, this is the catalyst for what makes him the leading man that he is today. I think this movie's great. And
yeah.
Any final thoughts before we cut to commercial break?
I don't think so. Great movie. I love his morning routine. I've watched 2 hours of that.
Yeah. The face peel, the reverse sit-ups. Good.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, I wish I had that type of dedication, but if it means I had to be a sociopath to do it, I think I'm actually good. So we're going to cut to commercial break really quickly before we get into our number 18 pick for our top 25 movies of the past 25 years. Do not go anywhere. We will be right back with Outside the Frame, London's only movie talk show. .9 FM Radio Western. You are still tuned in to Outside the Frame, London's only movie talk show. We are in the midst of our part two of our top 25 movies of the past 25 years. So far, we are going through our picks. We are going through our picks right now for numbers 20 to 16.
Yep.
We have spoken about The Dark Knight and American Psycho so far. So we are on to our 18th pick.
It's all you, buddy. It's all you.
Yes, I will happily
take the reins.
I will happily carry the torch for this movie. Obviously, I know that you both have. I've seen your Letterboxd rating for this movie, Sam. And
Wait, I don't even remember what it is. Oh,
fantastic.
No.
We're about to find out. You didn't do your research? Come on. Okay, so, but I spoke to Ryan about this earlier. Our number 18 film would be Get Out.
How do you feel now?
I can't move.
You can't move.
Why can't I move?
You're paralyzed. Just like that day when you did nothing. You did nothing. Now, sink into the floor.
Wait.
Sink.
So.
Get out.
Now, this movie, written and directed by Jordan Peele, came out in 2017. It is the directorial debut of Jordan Peele, who was one half of the sketch comedy group Key and Peele.
Yep.
And
great show, by the way.
Now, I know.
Unbelievable. I love that show so much.
So good. Those two are comedy geniuses.
I remember when I was younger, we would be after dinner and my family would gather around our desktop and just watch Key and Peele skit. It was like absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah, and to this day, some of the most rewatchable comedy skits ever. Now, I don't know if you two knew what the zeitgeist or what the culture was looking like around 2017 when this movie came out. You guys were probably like, what, 16?
I was 16.
So that means you were probably 15?
I think I was 14.
14. I don't know how online, as Mike likes to say, you guys were at that time. This movie was a big deal. There was a lot riding on this movie because I remember working at Cineplex at the time and everybody saw a trailer for a horror movie directed by Jordan Peele. And people were leaving the theater after the movie and coworkers of mine were discussing it thinking, is this a comedy movie that's just being marketed as a horror movie? Or if they found out it was a horror movie, it was, oh God, what business does Jordan Peele have directing a horror movie? Mm-hmm. It was a very confusing time for a lot of people who were going into this movie. But then the moment it hit, it was a smash hit.
Yep.
This movie made $259 million worldwide.
Off a budget of what?
I want to say it was something like $4
million. $4.5 million.
It made so much dough.
And domestically alone, it made $176
million. Printing money.
Jordan Peele, it like truly hit something. This movie's a cultural phenomenon, and it was right off the bat.
Yeah.
Everything about this movie hit audiences in the right way.
Yeah.
And obviously, horror is a good genre where that can happen. We see that pretty often. But this was on a whole nother level. Like, this was a smash hit. This movie was released in February of 2017.
Right.
And one of the rare cases where a movie that comes out in the first half of the year ended up being nominated and winning an Oscar.
Yep.
It won one Oscar for Best Original Screenplay for Jordan Peele. Got him his Oscar.
Yes.
For people who don't know about the movie Get Out, this movie is about a young African-American man who visits his white girlfriend's parents for the weekend, where his simmering uneasiness about their reception of him eventually reaches a boiling point.
Okay, That's not saying much.
That's not saying much.
That's not saying much.
That sounds like Guess Who's Coming to Dinner or the remake Guess Who. It sounds a lot like that, but that is probably the most tame way you could frame this movie. But I think also the best, because the less you know about this movie going into it, the better. I didn't know a whole lot going into it besides that, and I was I think that this is to me, this is a 5-star movie. This movie shook the world. It shook how like horror movies would follow it,
right?
At least in the mainstream, anyway.
Launched a lot of careers.
Launched
as well.
Quite a few. I'm so glad you brought
careers.
That up.
Yep. Yep.
Daniel Kaluuya,
as well as what's his face? This is bad. I don't know his name.
Are you talking about Little Red Howery?
No, I'm talking about he was in Atlanta.
Oh, Lakeith Stanfield.
Yeah, Lakeith Stanfield.
Lakeith Stanfield,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Bradley Whitford's in this movie.
Right.
Catherine
right.
Keener.
Yep.
Allison Williams.
Allison
Williams is in
Allison
this movie.
Allison Williams. Yeah.
A lot of great people in this movie. I mean, yeah, Lakeith Stanfield gets to say the title in the movie.
Yes, Get Out.
Yeah, he's the one who actually gets to say that.
It really, like, not to you can't downplay it at all how big this movie was. Like, everyone was talking about it. I remember so many of us in high school at the time going out to see this movie because it was just everywhere. Like, you had to go see Get Out.
Yes, 100%. And I mean, it clearly, not only was it just a smash hit, because, you know, you could talk about how big a movie was, but we've talked about Endgame. And yep. That's like one of the biggest movies of this, but it didn't make our list, right?
Yep.
There had to be a certain level of quality to these yes. movies as well.
Yep.
Which this movie does. You know, you could talk about how, you know, well the camera work was, or how well acted it was, which it was. Daniel Kaluuya puts in a phenomenal performance.
Yep.
Great performances all around, but a star-making one by Daniel Kaluuya. But I think where this really shines is... It's satirical elements. I think it clearly borrows from other horror movies like Night of the Living Dead, and then in particular, Stepford Wives and Rosemary's Baby.
Right.
But it still manages to turn those inspirations into a very fresh concept. And, you know, by blending the removal of bodily autonomy into a clever way of exposing cultural appropriation.
Right.
I think that it is so clever in the way it does that. It is so well done. I think this movie also does what other great horror movies in the past, again, speaking of Rosemary's Baby,
right.
have done before. You know, they hold a mirror up to society, as Mike would say, and show what's wrong with it and mm-hmm. how scary it actually is. So so in Rosemary's Baby, bodily autonomy, and the, please, I hope I'm saying this word right, but like the domesticity.
Okay.
Like the domestic, like of women at the time and of wives at the time and mothers. So removing that bodily autonomy, but in this case, how black bodies are seen as shells,
right,
and not really as the souls that inhabit them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether this be through like athleticism or hypersexualization, so on and so on, I think this movie does a really good job at bringing those into the modern era,
right,
putting a good twist on them.
Right.
I think this also does a really good job at encapsulating what, you know, primarily North America, but primarily America was like in... you know, during the like Obama years, like from like 2008 to 2016.
Absolutely.
Or what I like to call the we solved racism, everybody.
Yes.
Era.
Can I talk about my favorite line in the movie?
Please. Because, yeah, please.
I would have voted for Obama if he ran a third term.
And that's exactly it, right? Like,
yep.
Which is a line that has stuck in the zeitgeist for so long.
Dude, because, you still see it on memes.
Because it's so true,
yeah.
Right? It encapsulates that upper middle class liberal mindset that we've completely moved past the evil, like the evilness that surrounded racism.
And you know, I'm so sophisticated. I'm above all of that, obviously. And
yes,
ha.
Yeah, exactly. And I just think it does it in such a brilliant way that they were able to, you know, that mindset. And that mindset that you just described, while also finding a way to make the villains in this upper middle class liberal people. You know, it's not like The Hills Have Eyes, where there are a bunch of like mutant hillbillies that live in the hills.
Yeah.
You know, where it's like, oh, they're so far removed that they can't understand the evil. These people very well understand the evil that they're doing.
Yep.
No matter how well they present themselves, there is still an evil within them. I think that is just remarkable. Remarkably done.
Yeah.
Yep.
I really love the way you said that. I think I can't even add anything to that. That was brilliant. I agree 100%. And don't remember the next thing I was going to say. It's great movie. Yeah, I think this is one of the few movies that I was looking at on my Letterboxd where just like everyone that I follow has seen it. And I love plot twists. I think that was like a really big thing for me watching this movie, just the plot twist itself. I did have one thing to mention too, is every time we've talked about this movie before on the show, though, we have had a little bit of a debate on the timing of it and the first versus second half, and should the first half be quicker or should the second half be quicker, and what the heck.
Yeah, you know what, I would love to talk about that, but we don't have Mike here, and And I know that the last time this got brought up, Mike and I said that we were going to eventually have to have an on-air debate about it. And yes. I know Mike wanted to keep things positive for the sake of the top 25 movies.
Right.
So, because I know he does have his, I know he does not hate this movie, but I know that he does have his issues with it. that we've all three of us have heard before. Speaking of that, I would like to talk about that, but I feel it's unfair if I say my piece and Mike's not here to defend his piece.
Mike's not
here. Because again, I think this is a 5-star movie. Like personally, that's where I have this. And I know Mike doesn't agree with that for many reasons that I disagree with. But I think that this movie is actually quite well paced. And I'm really glad you brought that up, Sam, because I think it is very well paced. And I think a lot of the reason for that is because of the humor that this movie has. This movie is actually quite funny. Whether it is Lil Rel Howery, I think I'm right. pronouncing his name right, the TSA sidekick.
Right.
Or just like the uncomfortable nature of what people are saying in front of Daniel Kaluuya's character.
Right.
I think that this movie blends humor really well into it. And you can see this type of inspiration come later on in the horror comedy blend. You see that a lot following this, specifically The Menu, both of Zach Cregger's movies, Barbarian and Weapons.
Yep.
Very much borrow from that. So, and I'm sure we'll see it, you know, mm-hmm. further and further on.
Where do you guys see Jordan Peele's career headed?
I mean, off this movie alone, he kind of shot himself into the stratosphere of the most exciting directors working right now.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
At least mm-hmm. according to, you know, public perception. I think that he's already, you know, one of the most sought after directors. I think that he, going from here to answer your question, he's got to just keep it up. You know, he's had three very successful movies, and I don't see the next one not being successful. He's a blockbuster director at this point. Nope was less of a horror movie, more of like a thriller adventure. We will see if he stays within the horror genre. That I'm actually interested to see. Maybe he'll go more adventure, but he is a horror head, so who knows?
Yeah, we'll
see.
I think he's probably going to be doing a lot of producing in the future as well with his production company. Obviously, they have him coming out in a couple weeks. I don't know what else he's going to get up to in terms of actually directing and writing. We'll have to see. I haven't heard anything about what the next project from him is going to look like, but definitely, yeah. I mean, he produced him. That's coming out soon. So if you need an itch for your Jordan Peele kind of scratch here, then go see him.
Absolutely. Comes out in a couple of weeks. To further your question, Sam, I think it's really exciting that he is helping he's using his production company to help other people kind of like get their start, especially in original horror movies. Obviously Candyman wasn't that he was a producer on, but both Barbarian and him are both original horror movies.
Right.
So using his production company to kind of elevate those, I think is really admirable. And I hope he keeps doing that. Any final thoughts from everybody? I have spoken so much about this movie. So is there any final thoughts from you two on why Get Out is our number 18 pick?
Nope. That's all for me.
You covered it.
Okay. Well, why don't we move into our number 17 pick then? And that would be the only case that this will happen in this list at any point. We have one movie that is essentially encapsulating three different movies in this trilogy. But one of them had to make it, and this was the one that we decided upon, that we settled on. That would be Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King.
I see in your eyes the same fear that would take the heart of me. A day may come when the courage of men fails, when we forsake our friends and break all bonds of fellowship. But it is not this day. An hour of wolves and shattered shields when the age of men comes crashing down. But it is not this day. This day we fight. By all that you hold dear on this good earth, I bid you stand! Men of the West!
Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King. This movie came out in 2003. It started with The Fellowship of the Ring, which came out in 2001. And there was a movie each year to precede it.
Yep.
And this was the massive conclusion.
Filmed them all kind of at once as well.
Yeah, it took a very unlike any other movie.
Yeah.
It took a full year of shooting. Just to get the raw footage for this movie, it took a full year for them to shoot it.
Yep.
In New Zealand. And then it was edited afterwards. And the first one was put out while they were still editing the second one, so on and so forth. They were able to catch up. This movie is directed by Peter Jackson. It is an adaptation of the classic J.R.R. Tolkien novel series.
Either one works.
It was adapted by Fran Walsh and Philippa Boyens?
I don't know.
Now, this is the best way to describe this movie. I have the synopsis for this third one that I will read in a second. But the whole thing is that there is a very powerful and mystical ring that enters...
Are you explaining Lord of the Rings?
In the fastest way possible. It is a very powerful and mystical ring. It finds itself in the hands of Frodo Baggins.
Right.
And he must journey... across very many landscapes,
right,
in order to throw this into the only volcano that can destroy the ring, because it is evil. Now a lot happens, obviously, in between during this journey. He meets a wide breadth of characters. A lot of battle sequences happen. In this particular one, you will not understand this if you have not seen any of these movies, but I'm going to read it because I need to give people an idea of what this third one was about. Gandalf and Aragorn lead the world of men against Sauron's army to draw his gaze from Frodo and Sam as they approach Mount Doom and the One Ring. Again, so many names there that if you've never seen this, you don't know who they are. Now, why is this movie on our top 25 films of the past 25 years?
You want me to
any of you can
take
a
crack? Go ahead, Sam. You look like you're going to say something.
Okay. Again, I never found much of like a really like, Lord of the Rings, I love it. But I liked what you were saying earlier about how it took forever to film. And I feel like I don't think we really give a lot of credit to movies that are just like projects. Just unbelievable, like massive projects. And I think a couple of weeks ago, someone on the show was saying that, like, something about Dune and how we're not going to get another Denis movie for a while because it's, like, it's such a huge project. But I also think that sort of a thing has its own space in the film world, and it is really great. I mean, they have conventions for this sort of thing. And so this movie really speaks to, like, the Harry Potter of it all and the sort of, and, like, the trilogies and, like, the big, ginormous sectors. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I feel like, we don't have a lot of movies on this list really covering that.
Yeah, that's a very good point. This movie is so grand. This movie is so, like, it is the true, I don't like using this word in most cases, but this movie is the true definition of an epic, especially when you're talking about movies, right? Like, this movie, the scale of this movie has yet to be replicated. Filming for a year, I mean, the battle sequences that are on display here, the CGI work that goes into this, the character design, the costume design, the character preparation, like, there is just so much of this. What's that, sorry?
No,
did you say the wigs?
It is
the wigs.
Do you wear wigs?
Do you wear wigs?
When will you wear wigs? I mean, it is the epic of the 21st century in a sense that it is like, in terms of a film context, it's like Lawrence of Arabia. It's like Ben-Hur. It's this big, giant, sprawling epic that we may never see ever again. And it's so contained, and every film in the trilogy is so well-crafted. And the story is just a perfect through line. And it's really, in terms of film, I mean, it is one of the, it is adapting in the 21st century, it's for film, it's adapting one of the most important English, at least English language stories of the 20th century. And it's just the themes that it presents. It is so incredibly important, these films and what they present and what they represent at the same time. And so, and also, it's just won a bunch of Oscars.
Yeah.
It
yeah.
won, did we talk about the Oscars?
We did not yet.
It won an insane amount of Oscars. I had to make sure I didn't swear there.
It won 11 Oscars, which in the grand scheme of things is already a lot. Until you factor in that it was nominated for 11 Oscars.
So it won every single thing it was
every
nominated.
Every single clean sweep. Award it was nominated for, it won.
Yeah. And
clean sweep.
A bit of that also has to do with, and we discussed this off the show, that the other two films got robbed quite a bit because, and then it kind of seemed like by the time the third one came around, okay, we gotta award this thing because it's such a big moment and such a
right.
huge accomplishment. Really, when you look back on it, probably Fellowship also should have won Best Picture the year that it was nominated as well. But we have Return of the King. And
yes.
Return of the King kind of represents the whole trilogy because of that.
Yeah. The Fellowship of the Ring, 2001, that movie lost Best Picture to A Beautiful Mind. And The Two Towers, 2002, would have lost Best Picture, if my memory serves me correct. That would be Chicago that it lost Best Picture to. So 2003, I'm okay with it winning because it was the grand finale, and that's kind of what the Oscars, that's kind of their game anyways.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, they usually wait till the third one. So it does make sense. I'm glad what you said, though, about it, like, about the scale.
Yes.
And what it's done and how we may never see something of this scale again. This has really set the standard for not just fantasy films, fantasy anything.
Yes.
Like fantasy anything that deals with visual representation. I mean, I think of the things that have been inspired by this now, stuff like Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Elden Rings.
Yep.
God, Narnia.
Yeah.
Well,
Narnia is an interesting one too because it was written at the same time as Lord of the Rings.
It was,
which
but
is
I'm thinking
very funny, and they knew each other, the two authors.
But the visual representation of Narnia didn't come out until 2 years after the
that
conclusion.
Is true. That is true.
Right. So they had, I think they had
in
enough
terms
time
of,
to
of film media.
Yes.
Everything is a footnote.
Yes.
After this,
even Dune, even like you mentioned earlier, Dune,
yeah.
like even Dune in its scale. It, like you can make a very strong argument for it taking inspiration from how Lord of the Rings was shot and executed. Now, because of that standard being set, this is, I believe, the only fantasy, spoiler alert, I believe this is the only fantasy film in our top 25. And there's a reason, because it is the only one that could possibly go on this list.
Yep.
This trilogy is just breathtaking in its scale.
It's iconic.
I know I keep saying scale, but it's just because that is that's what would I'd have to use one word. It's monumental.
Yep.
And it works for so many reasons. The performances, I mean, Gollum alone is such a memorable character. It is, this entire thing has stayed in our zeitgeist for so long. The writing, the delivery of the dialogue is almost Shakespearean at times. Yeah, I could go on, but this movie is just huge, and so well executed, so ambitious, and nails, it just sticks the landing on every front. Anything else to say? Any last thoughts before we get into our last film of this broadcast?
No thoughts for me.
No.
Okay. So we move into our number 16 pick and our last pick for our part two. And that would be the movie, the 2003 movie, Lost in Translation.
Does it get easier?
No. Yes. It gets easier.
Oh, yeah? Look at you.
Thanks. The more you know who you are and what you want, the less you let things upset you.
Yeah.
Now, this movie is written and directed by Sofia Coppola. It stars Bill Murray, Scarlett Johansson, Anna Faris, Giovanni Ribisi, makes a second appearance on this list. This movie is about a fading movie star who falls for a lonely young woman in Tokyo. Now, that may seem like a very bare description, but that is exactly what the movie's about. Not a lot of plot happens in this movie. In fact, I put this movie in the genre of nothing happens.
It's a film for people who love loneliness.
Yeah, nothing happens, but a lot happens.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're absolutely right. Anybody
Do you like heartbreak?
This yeah. is for you.
But that's the thing about this movie, though, is that it's like 100%, like it's 0% plot and just 100% emotion.
Yes. Yes.
And so the whole time you're just like clutching your chest, just like, but it's so hard to put into words why it, like, what it does, because it's just all emotion and not like, and nothing else.
Yeah. And you know what? That speaks, I mean, it won one Oscar, and that was for Best Original Screenplay for Sofia Coppola. And I think that that is so well deserved in this case, because for you to have a movie that has, quite frankly, zero plot, but is fully reliant on, and I don't say that as a negative, because there's quite a few movies where there's not a lot of plot happening because they focus entirely on the characters, which can draw your emotion. If you're so deeply connected to these characters, you can find emotion in them and you can get that emotion in you drawn out. And I think that she does it so well with these characters. They're so well written. The dialogue between them is so natural. And so it really does speak to how well written this movie is. And how well acted it is. I mean, Bill Murray and Scarlett Johansson are giving like career best performances in this movie. To this day, it might still be some of their best work.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that like in terms of the Sofia Coppola aspect of it being on the list, like absolutely, I think she should be on the list. And in terms of her other movies, I think this one just has more of a sting than the other ones. And so I think that that's why it just has such a great place on this list. And yeah.
I think that the only movie that might rival this is, at least in Sofia Coppola's catalog, would be The Virgin Suicides. But that movie came out in 1999, so it couldn't be on the list even if we wanted it to. Yes. So I think that this movie is well deserved. I think this is this the first time we see Bill Murray in a dramatic role?
No. Maybe fully dramatic. I mean, like, he was in Rushmore before this.
But that's like a screwball kind of like oddball a comedy, sorry.
So it might be. It might be his kind of first like traditional drama. Yeah.
Yeah, and there and are
fantastic in it.
He's. I think this is still his best role, mm-hmm. And it is still his favorite of his performances. So I mean, it shows. I mean, he's talked about it very openly.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think part of that was because it was written for him.
That's true.
Sofia Coppola has been on record saying that this movie was directly written for Bill Murray. In fact, if he didn't agree to it, it probably wouldn't have gotten made.
That's so interesting that she did that.
Yeah.
Because it's also like you got to look at his career at that point. It's like Rushmore maybe beforehand. I guess maybe she saw something in that.
Maybe.
Or maybe she heard something. Obviously, you know, she has relatives, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know what I mean?
She's got relatives. Yeah.
She has relatives.
Good point.
I mean, Jason Schwartzman, who is in Rushmore, is her cousin.
Right.
So
exactly.
Definitely it was like, hey, you need to do a movie with you, like, you never know what happens in these scenarios, but it's interesting that it happened and it's cool that it happened.
Rushmore's an interesting through line because he does play even though it's played up again, back to the whole discussion of actors being framed differently. You know, you have Bill Murray in Rushmore and he's playing this very sad man going through a divorce.
Yep.
But it's played for laughs for the majority of it. Whereas he is a sad man going through a divorce in this movie.
Utter despair.
And utter despair.
Utter despair and sadness
loneliness.
And melancholy.
Melancholy, you know? So I think that there is something to be said about how well he fits in that performance. And again, back to Sofia Coppola, one of the best directors, writer-directors of the past 25 years, in how she was able to frame Bill Murray in this movie. I think this is a great pick. Any final thoughts on Lost in Translation before we wrap it up?
I don't think so.
All right.
Yeah, I think I just think that her, like Sofia Coppola, like honestly kind of similar to Wes Anderson, she's very distinct style that a lot of people really love.
Yeah.
And I think that that's really important for this century.
I 100% agree. I 100% agree. Well, we've made it through our part two of our top 25 movies of the past 25 years. Just to repeat this list, at number 20, we had The Dark Knight. At number 19, we had American Psycho. At number 18, we had Get Out. At number 17, we had Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King. And at number 16, we had Lost in Translation. We will continue this list in a month, the first Tuesday of October. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in to Outside the Frame. My name is Elijah.
I'm Ryan.
I'm Sam.
And we will see you all next week. See you, Sam. Thank you so much for joining us from Italy.
Bye.
Bye.